Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour, May 31st, 2012. And tonight's main science topic, I will be talking about the pillar of fire, the Moses pillar of fire, and the scientific explanation for this, and a lot of other details. Whenever you bring up a topic like this, talk about it in the scientific sense, when I examine this, what it does is it brings up a dozen other topics that have to be explained to put the whole story together. And of course, in the modern world, I go to services, I go with people, I go to various church services of all denominations, and what I find is that most people, most preachers today are just kind of feel good. Oh, we have to do better to bring ourselves closer, you know, whatever it is. And it's touchy-feely, good, feel good, everybody should leave feeling a little better, like their life, you know. And it's so, I'll tell you, it's so mundane that I don't know if it just, to me, it's not an experience. But they're not teaching the real issues here. They certainly don't teach the Old Testament as if it were real. They don't talk about Moses. They don't talk about the Moses event. They don't talk about the Noah flood. They don't talk about the fact that the Bible itself is a historical record, a genealogy of the Israelite tribes as they came and went, and one generation preceded the next. It's a lineage, and it brings you all the way down to the year zero, but it's a piece of history. It's a piece of history, and it's not taught like history. They kind of avoid it, like they really don't want to talk about that topic over there because it's kind of fairy tale. So at any rate, I want to break that mold, and I'm going to quote from my webpage here. I just put up a posting the other day, and it's kind of a twist, a turn in the way I'm going to be presenting material for some time to come. And I think people will like this concentration that I'm going to start to do. I'm going to start concentrating on ancient texts and the history of ancient disasters. My latest release is entitled The Physics of Planet X and Ancient Celestial Disasters. This release is a 2-CD set with 18 hours of lectures covering a long list of topics, not only the physics of ancient disasters, but also the psychology of modern and ancient thought. That's that 2-CD set. It's available on my webpage. I know a lot of people have already purchased that. I think it's like $12 for the 2-CD set, and you can get two of the 2-CD sets, including shipping, free shipping, for like $23 or $24, something like that. At any rate, that's what I'm talking about here. But it talks about ancient disasters, the physics of ancient disasters, and the psychology. So if you look at the composite of my released works, they span the topics of Planet X, or the many Planet X objects, the electrical nature of the solar system, the physics of solar system weather, and how it comes down to affect Earthlings. I talk about the ancient science and the electrical propulsion systems that are in nature's plan to take us off this planet and to the stars. And I talk about the order in the universe, starting with the basics of numbers and the rhythms of prime numbers in an equation that directly calculates prime numbers. In my book, it's called Calculate Primes. Resolving the oldest standing problem of all of mathematics. This leads to some very interesting concepts regarding the order of the universe. My latest book, The Diamond Principle, analyzes modern society and science from a viewpoint in the future using nature's laws, and then gives the direction that we must follow in the future as we go into outer space. Unfortunately, the direction of man's space is heading down the road of taking man's fixation with resource mongering into space as early commercial ventures, I space resources for plunder and profit. It's almost like the old pirate days. Somebody gets there first. I can just imagine that if two of these groups get to the moon or an asteroid at the same time and start, who knows, bring out the lasers and start shooting at each other. It's mine. No, it's mine. No, it's, you know, it's just, or trying to use government to prevent the other group from getting ahead. This is all going to happen. This is all going to be behind the scene, dirty pool, pirates stealing from one group, and, you know, it's just going to, it's what's going to happen. They're taking man's weakest greed into space, and that's, it's, it looks all great on the cover. But at any rate, this is only one endpoint, this idea of commercializing space ventures. Now, let me make it real clear. I'm not talking about Branson. Branson, in my eyes, is a really well-seasoned businessman. What he's doing is very interesting. It's space tourism. But there's some other people out there that are looking to plunder outer space. And that's what I disagree with. Like I say, it has only one endpoint, and that's taking man's petty ways into space. So is there an object out there that has our collective name on it that will destroy man before his greed takes us all down like the Titanic? So anyway, in my upcoming public work, I will be concentrating on the ancient world, the world we live in, and how we must move in into the future. So I'm going to outline these directions, the past, the present, and the future, and push us into the future, and not just talk about it. I'll be doing things, and you'll be seeing those things. So at any rate, I want you to follow this new direction. And it's not really a new direction for me. It's just something I'm going to concentrate on in my public appearances, etc. And there's some stuff in the works now. You will be seeing it as time goes on. Some new public releases, let's just put it that way. I think you'll be very interested in the new direction that many of these my personal research and work is going to take here. And by the way, something else I'm working on in the background that's kind of been underway for a long time is upgrading my webpage. So that I hope that someday soon you will go to my webpage and find a new look and feel to it. So at any rate, keep an eye out for that. Tonight, I will be the main guest on Coast to Coast AM. I believe it's going to be the first hour. Yeah, at any rate, you can go to the Coast to Coast AM webpage and see the details. And I'll be talking about this, in fact, this same concept, this new direction, and the analysis of ancient history. Basically, what can we learn from it? Turns out we can learn a lot of physics, we can learn a lot of space science, and we can learn a lot about living. We can learn about how to avoid the mistakes of the past. So that is something that, like I say, just my direction in life is... Here's my thought. Let me kind of let you walk through my innermost thoughts at this time and take a look at what I'm thinking. We have to start doing things. We can't continue talking and analyzing. We have to start doing. And so at any rate, that's something that I want to give people direction. Last week I talked about a concept called First Nation, in which people simply start living their own democracy. The world is such a mess. We have psychopaths running the nation here. We have people, we have corporations lined up around the Capitol. They can't wait to get the next corporate handout, tax break, government contract, whatever it is, and there's no morality at all. Greed has just taken over. Corporate profits are king and rule the world. I travel a lot to third world countries, and I see the devastation there in the plight of the people, and they are just in the dirt with no place to go, and literally their governments have already sold out their future to the Western banking systems. So it's not just the banks, it's all the corporations that line up around the governments that are supported, the loans, the infinite amount of interest, the countries cannot pay it back, so it just drives the people farther into slavery. And the middlemen, the presidents and the Congress and the companies and the agencies, the same kind of political model, basically, as most of the Western world. Their people are just pushed down to the point. Now, there are some countries out there that are waking up, but it's not easy. As soon as they wake up, if they have decent, legitimate, honest leaders, they are called terrorists, and they're just driven into the ground by the Western powers that basically represent the European banking community. So at any rate, that's why it's important for someone, from my analysis of ancient events, I want to bring this into how does, for example, tonight I'll be talking about the pillar of fire of Moses. How does that relate to us today? The weather today, it has a tremendous number of relationships with what is going on today and what may occur in our future. So it's very important to learn from the past. And the other thing I want to do is I don't want to just give a cursory outline and it's kind of a gee-whiz lecture and walk away. I want to pick these topics apart piece by piece, analyzing them, going back and looking and taking the physics of that and then relating it to our lives now and talking about what was going on in the solar system at the time. Okay, so anyway, just a little bit of an introduction, something that you will see in my particular work coming out in the future. First of all, winds, strange. We have many had in the past week, and this has been going on for quite some time now. In fact, I've talked about this on previous shows, quite a few previous shows, that the winds have been very strange. Now, they haven't been excessively strong. They have been, you know, consistent. But there's something strange in the wind. And I want you, and there are a lot of places where it's been relatively normal. What we've had are lots of small microcell systems. And sometimes they'll just sit in a spot for a long period of time. So someone may not have noticed these. It may not have been in their area. But if you've been in an area where these storms just come in and sit there, and you have 2 to 3 weeks of heavy wind coming in from one direction or another direction, and it's just constant. A lot of weather that appears to be like August-type weather, hot, humid. And like I say, possibly you've been in an area where there hasn't been a lot of storm activity, but I have been in many areas because I travel and I take note of these things, that the winds are strange. They're kind of like, they're not happy winds, let's put it that way. They're not the kind of in springtime, you know, you feel that spring feeling and that gentle breeze blowing from the south, and you know that the flowers are going to be blooming, etc. No, in May we were having 90 degree weather with high humidity. And very, you know, that kind of late August weather when the corn is growing, through the ceiling and is, you know, that hot August very sticky weather. You know, we've had that in early May. So at any rate, the winds, something strange is going on, and I can't really put my finger on it exactly, but of course all of this weather, all of the energy for these weather systems comes from the sun, from the electrical currents that are coming by Earth all the time. And this is important in, for example, relating back to the Moses pillar of fire. When I talk about that, associated with that were winds, high winds. They talk about the winds, the Israelites as they left Egypt. There were tremendous winds out in the desert. And of course, the desert always has winds. So what's so unusual about that? Well, a lot of other conditions were observed at the time and reported at the time. So I want to bring up a question, first of all, is, are the ancient tales or legends, are they believable? And I think a lot of the churches, like I say, that would be the main place where someone would be talking about these topics. They just don't talk about them. It's like, well, they're not real. And I think it all comes back to modern astronomy, which denies all of this, basically says none of this happened. Science has no explanation for it, so therefore it didn't happen. That's what's going on today. There's no explanation from standard science, so how could this possibly happen? Well, the end result is that, yes, this is very believable historical material, the pillar of fire of Moses, and there are very sound explanations for this. I just want to sidetrack a little bit, a couple topics here. First of all, the Fukushima disaster, it's very clear that the Japanese government and industry, the company called TEPCO, Tokyo Electric Power Company, are basically burying their head in the sand. What's becoming clear now from other reports that are coming out is that the Japanese people have complained. They've tried to petition. They've tried to get the government to stick with its original policy of only storing so much spent fuel at the site. It turns out that the Fukushima plant has been storing fuel since 1973, if you can imagine that. So it has decades and decades of spent fuel rods just in canisters sitting around the facility there. And the Japanese people were told that, oh, this would be recycled, it would go away, it wouldn't be stored there, and it's just not the case. Now they are faced with a very real situation. I just can't believe the story that came out. It's like this minister of energy climbed this rickety little ladder, leaned over the edge, and sanctioned the number 4 cooling pool at Fukushima, saying, oh, it looks pretty good to me. And everybody goes, oh, it's according to this guy, it looks okay. It's so absurd. I mean, it's just, but the problem is, this is very dangerous. If that thing goes, then they're going to, there's no question about what's going to happen. The fuel has to be stored in cooling towers. This fuel has to be stored in water where the radiation is absorbed. If not, those canisters would fall down into a big pile, start heating up, they would go into meltdown. And here's the problem. It's like any heat-generating system. In a big pile laying on the ground, all of a sudden, they're going to start building up heat. That heat has no place to go. And the radiation is going to accelerate. A meltdown will occur. The next thing that will happen is that adjacent storage facilities at the Fukushima number 4 plant will start to catch on fire, in which case all of those casks will burn. They will burn, all the radiation will be released into the environment. Some will be washed into the ocean. The rest will go into the atmosphere. And really, at that point, it would radiate for sure the Hawaiian Islands, a lot of Alaska, Canada, the United States, Mexico, when those winds blow across the Pacific Ocean, picking up that radiation. Then it gets dumped into the ocean, basically killing the Pacific Ocean. The Japanese government, the Japanese corporations are just completely in denial, and they're trying to make it sound like they're really doing their job. They came out with a report saying that in a year, at the end of 2013, so even more than a year, they were going to start a program of moving these casks out of there. But it just sounds like more of the same. Put it off into the future. Don't talk about it now. Don't cause any expenses now. And that's probably the biggest issue, is they don't want to spend the money, because nor do they want to admit that they had a failed nuclear policy, because they want to keep the Japanese people hooked on nuclear energy. Now, just a side note, one thing that I will be including in future shows and in future releases are details regarding alternative energy. It's something that I have worked on in the past. It's something that I feel very strongly about, and something I've analyzed the industry. I've been on major radio shows talking about these topics. It was, I think, February of 2011. I was on the Coast to Coast AM radio show as a guest, did a full show interview on what I call the myth of alternative energy. So it's a topic that I understand well. It has to be analyzed from a physics point of view. And the politicians, the businessmen, should never, ever have been allowed to run nuclear power, because they're going to make a decision. The scientists are going to come and say, look, this is going to happen. This is a disaster waiting to happen. And what do the politicians and the businessmen do? Well, that's great information, but that's going to cost us money. So therefore, what they decide to do is to save the expense and forget about doing what's necessary. So you have a reactor that's completely in meltdown and ready to basically cause a worldwide disaster, and they are walking around with their head in the sand. It's a topic that I will continue to follow. It's a topic that many other people, talk show hosts, have been following, and I'll continue to analyze this from my point of view. Just a quick aside note, when I was going to school, college and graduate level physics, I met, of course, people who were going to be nuclear engineers. Nuclear power has some very limited applications. And it turns out that there's been a lot of irresponsible handling of nuclear radiation. The Navy has been dumping their nuclear waste from their ships. They take it out to the middle of the ocean, where there's a big crevice in the bottom of the ocean, and they drop it down there, hoping that it's going to go away. Well, when those casks break and melt, that radiation is going to come bubbling out, and it's going to pollute the ocean. There's no tracking of this. There's no good information. It's all done where the public can't see it. And they're just destroying the ocean, which will destroy the world and man's ability and all creatures' ability to live on this planet. So at any rate, the Fukushima disaster, and it's something where scientists should simply walk in and say, this is the way it's going to be. This has to be dealt with. This is what has to be done. You have to build this kind of a structure. You have to fill it with heavy water. You have to move these tanks one by one. They're talking about moving just a few of the canisters. It sounds like a feel-good type of placating the public, like we're doing something. No, they're not doing anything. all of the nuclear reactors in Japan, in my opinion, should be shut down. And the idea that profit has to take is the central decision making factor is absolutely absurd. Okay, so at any rate, I will be back on that topic. Just another quick mention of cancer. Past weeks I've been talking about cancer. I talked about what I learned when I was in graduate school. My biophysics course was taught by a doctor, an MD from the biophysics school at Tulane University. And like I said before, he said, we know what cancer is all about. It's unbridled, uncontrolled generation of cells because the cells in that region do not see the adjacent cell. What causes that? If you get a solvent in there or some other chemical, or you get damage to the cells, if you get a lack of fluid in between the cells that carries the electrochemical signal, any of these things can cause loss of signal, but those cells start reproducing because they don't see the cell next to them, so they start reproducing as if they were bridging a gap in a cut. And so then you get the tumor, you get the uncontrolled cell growth, and that's cancer. It happens in people with high acidity. There are some things that are known about this, and people with cancer tend to have a lot of fungus in their body. It starts growing, and so there's, of course, the heavy drugs, the heavy chemicals that they give people to try and so-called cure cancer, but the alternative treatments that are being experimented with within the public. And the public is getting to the point where they're just tired. They're tired of the medical industry. They're tired of the pharmaceutical industry. They're tired of the government trying to interfere with their health life. And they're very tired of not being able to get real decent information about illnesses, including cancer, when they go to the doctor. So at any rate, that's an ongoing issue. And I'll be talking more about that in the future. Thanks for everybody who sent in a lot of information. It's clear that there's just a ton of information out there on alternative treatments for cancer. Some of them you have to go to foreign countries. Some of them you can get in the United States. But just an incredibly mixed up industry. And the public is the losing entity in that whole game. Okay, on to the main science topic. And also as part of my delving into past, the physics of ancient events and picking them apart, going into to detail, I want to spend more of my show talking about science issues, the science issues of dealing with these ancient events. So onward to the pillar of fire of Moses. Now, if you read the Old Testament, they go through, they march through all of the various things, the plagues of Egypt, and then finally Moses leaving, the Pharaoh's chariots coming after him, and of course the parting of the Red Sea, where the Israelites cross the Red Sea, and then the Red Sea moves back and kills the Pharaoh's armies. By the way, they have found the chariots of Pharaoh in the Red Sea. They have been located and identified as, yes, these were the Pharaoh's chariots. National Geographic did a special on these. But these events were real. So that's the first point. This is not mythology. This is not hocus pocus or a pretty story in a book that for grade school kids and nobody else. This is serious business. These people, these things happened. And I want to further ask the question. Now, there's a lot of people out there who are Christians. These are basically traditions held within certain communities. But the point is, when I start talking about the scientific causes, the scientific effects that you're seeing here, a lot of people might say, well, I must be, the mechanic must be an atheist. He doesn't believe that God, well, the hand of God came in and did these things. And that is not the case at all. It is very interesting, and I'm not going to get into the argument of how the hand of God works. Does he use physical entities, physical scientific principles that are in existence in his universe to direct things? There's a whole set of complicated questions here. Were these just chance incidents? There was something came by that caused all of these events at the time. I have my own personal feelings on this, but that's not my point. The point is the events themselves can be explained in terms of the science of what was going on at the time. And very clearly, now I talked about this in my new CD set, the physics of one of the episodes, you might call it, one of the one-hour lectures, is regarding the Moses event. I also talk about the Noah event. The Noah event preceded the Moses event by thousands of years. There's, of course, not good time tracking, but the Noah event was a complete destruction of the earth by flooding. When the Moses event came along, so I think I said that correctly, that the Noah event was a complete destruction of earth. It rained for 40 days and 40 nights. Clearly, the earth was passing through a comet tail with the tremendous rain, the various effects, the high winds, etc. And, of course, the point of view, by the way, it's not just the Old Testament. You can go back into the history of every major civilization going back into history, and you see the same thing. They talk about the Great Flood. That when the Moses event was going on, the Mayan legends go back and talk about that. The Chinese legends. The legends come down to us from all corners of the world. And so I'd like to point something out here. Say that something happened. Let's say say there were a lot of people in a room. Okay? And let's say there was a crime committed. What would an investigator do? What would an investigator comes into the crime scene, or say some other type of event happened and a lot of people were there to witness it. And so the investigator didn't see it. The news media comes in, or the reporters, they didn't see it, and they want to find out what happened. But the real astute investigator, the first thing he would do is separate all of the witnesses. Well, this happened naturally. When the Mayans, the Tibetans, the Chinese, the Northern Europeans, the Incas were separated from the Mayas, all of these groups were naturally physically separated, and they weren't reunited, they weren't discovered until the era of exploration after Columbus discovered the New World. Of course, some people say, well, the Vikings also discovered the New World. Well, so did a lot of other people discovered the New World. It's just that Columbus brought that information back to Europe and got it going there, brought back the information that, hey, there's people there. And then once the explorers started discovering the information, unfortunately, they destroyed most of it. But the information that comes down from us, from these groups that were very much separated, due to the physical disasters that happened on this planet, these civilizations were separated for thousands of years and then later rediscovered, they all told the same story. So that's the corroborating evidence. And so I'm getting back to the example of the people in a, say, a collective room or a stadium or, say, in a city or whatever, they start recounting what happened. So if you separated all those people immediately and started questioning them individually, one at a time, If they all told you a different story, you'd go, yeah, these people are just making this up. But if they all told you exactly the same story, then you'd go, well, this is what happened. Because all these people who have been separated from the time the event happened didn't have time to talk to each other and make up this big complicated story, but they were all separated and they all come up and they all tell the same story. Well, that leads not only credibility, that pretty much tells you that that event happened. Okay, so then you look at the physical event. Okay, say that whatever the event was, you start looking at physical evidence that corroborates what the people told you. There's physical evidence. When the first naturalist first started coming across the what is now called the United States, they saw evidence of a great flood, and they reported this back. It was well documented. A guy named Ignatius Donnelly was the lieutenant governor of Minnesota. And he documented, he's got a big book, it's called Atlantis, the Antediluvian World, and it documents all of the natural findings of that time. And what he very clearly states is that there were earth-wide disasters, and the remnants of those disasters were all around them. So this kind of information, it's being reported back to us. Another thing, I like the point that Velikovsky makes, is that by the year 1900, across the United States, the plains, the Southwest, the United States, the Western states, what later became the Western states, all of the evidence, the trees that were in washes, were used for firewood, a lot of the other roads were built, things were plowed under, fields were plowed, and so the historical evidence of the Great Flood was basically destroyed by man, and by the 1900s, there was very little, if any, evidence left of the Great Flood. It had all been kind of erased by man's use of the land, use of resources. All of this evidence had gone away, so it's easy for modern science to say, oh, none of this ever happened. And people are now like, oh, well, maybe it didn't happen. Well, see, that's the problem. The problem is that modern science cannot explain it, so they put their head in the sand, say their theories are correct regarding how the solar system formed, how comets, what comets are, etc. And it turns out that they're simply wrong. I call it fairy tale science. There's the story they're presenting couldn't possibly be true. Even under very rudimentary, very basic analysis, the Dirty Snowball Comet model doesn't hold up to a third grade class a third grade class of kids. It doesn't make any sense. Yet they've built this huge wall of equations and papers published and analysis, and in reality, it doesn't make any sense. There are other parts, for example, how the solar system forms. It's like a nursery rhyme. Whenever they talk about planets forming or how the solar system formed, oh, it all formed 4.5 billion years ago. It's like pulling a rabbit out of the hat. That's what they say. If they repeat it enough times, people will start believing it. So, at any rate, the issue of the pillar of fire of Moses, okay, in the Old Testament, when Moses got to the Red Sea, there was a pillar of fire that formed, and it extended up into the heavens. What was it? What was going on at the time? Well, it's very clear that was at the same time that the Mayans were recording the events and talking about the planet Venus. The Mayans were extremely preoccupied with the planet Venus. The main ancient Mayan calendar deals with the cycles of Venus. They finally got it down to where they understood the cycles of Venus. and related it to the what our current 365-day year. But that's not always the way it was. Venus was a wandering entity in the solar system, and it finally settled into its current orbit, the one we see today. But as that comet, the comet that eventually became the planet Venus, as it came by Earth, that was at the time when the Israelites were coming out of Egypt. It was at the same time that the Mayans were reporting, and they lived through this event. They also report similar events. There are Indian groups in the United States that have records in their history of having tablets of laws, two tablets, just like the Moses tablets, in their history, being handed down with the and teaching them how to live like human beings, not like savages in the jungle. So it's interesting to see that these events are corroborated around the world. When talking once again about the pillar of fire, what would happen between a comet and Earth that would cause the people down on the ground to see a pillar of fire? Well, it's the electrical discharge between the comet and the ground of Earth. And it would sit there as the comet is passing by. It's a discharge that's going to come down, attached to Earth, and then move as the comet passes by. And it would take a good deal of time. It would sit there, and these people would observe this. Would there be tremendous winds associated with this? Yes. How can you relate this to modern weather? Well, part of my weather work shows how electrical discharges from the ionosphere ultimately power tornadoes. It's the same situation. When you look up the tube of a tornado, the few people that have lived through this, they say they see a tremendous amount of lightning. There are many, many videos and pictures of tornadoes showing lightning associated with the tornado. It's an electrical event. It's powered by electricity. And here's how it works. Let's just take an Earth basic small tornado. Small on the planetary scale. If you're in a tornado, I wouldn't call it small, but on a planetary scale, the tornadoes on Earth are relatively small. But at any rate, here's what happens. As the electrical discharge starts to break through the Earth's atmosphere, it ionizes the air near the ground. The air becomes ionized. It starts to move up a central column. In other words, there's an electric field. Those ions want to move upwards, but the path of least resistance is along the path of the electrical discharge coming down from the clouds, which ultimately is powered electrically by its attachment up into the upper atmosphere, which goes ultimately up to the ionosphere. Above storm and tornado clouds, they have seen X-rays. They've seen gamma rays. There's no explanation for this unless you understand that's all part of an electrical current. That's all part of an energy equation that connects outer space with Earth, the upper atmosphere, all the way down to the troposphere, all the way down to the surface of the Earth. The troposphere is basically 30,000 to say 30,000 to 100,000 feet that thunderstorms can form in and go all the way down to the ground. Okay, so now that electrical discharge to the ground is following a certain path. The ionized air at the ground starts to move up that central column, and it's just like the water going down the drain of a bathtub. It's a centralized, sucking that air up the central column. When water goes down a tub, it starts to rotate. It starts to make an eddy current or a cyclonic motion, a rotating motion. And that's exactly what happens when the ionized air gets pulled up into that column. It starts to rotate. That is what happens when ionized air starts to move up an electrical column. So let's take the comet Venus is passing by Earth. It's not colliding with Earth. It's passing by Earth. The electrical connection comes down from the highly charged comet nucleus. And what happens? It basically forms a gigantic tornado-type action at the surface of the Earth. And I like the movie, by the way, I'll be talking a lot about these type of effects from ancient history. But there's the movie, the original movie of the Ten Commandments with Charlton Heston. There was a real effort in that era, not the modern era where they try and change history, but back in that era they tried to keep it as realistic to the Old Testament as possible. And they show a great rendition of the pillar of fire. And of course, those people didn't understand what was going on. They didn't know what comets were. Remember that comets were not well understood until the time of Kepler, when he realized, because he could calculate, he could measure, he could do measurements and calculations of orbits around the sun, and he said, hey, these comet things are way out there. They're out in space, and they orbit the sun. That's why they call them Keplerian orbits, because of Kepler. He was the first one to discover this. Up to that time, the Greeks, all the way back to Aristotle, thought that the comets were fire in the atmosphere. Just up there a little ways, there was a fire, and that's what a comet was. And Kepler said, no, they're way out there. So the concept of what a comet is, you go back to Moses, they didn't know. They didn't know what a comet was. They didn't understand the electrical connection. All they were describing, all that you're going to get out of the ancient texts, is literally a description, a physical description of what they saw. They weren't trying to lie or make up things. It would be impossible for these people, these civilizations at that time, to make up stories like this. It just doesn't even make sense. So when they're talking about the earthquakes, they're talking about the pillar of fire, they're talking about the various effects, the high winds that accompanied the pillar of fire. And it just stood between them and Pharaoh's armies for a long period of time. So Pharaoh's armies could not advance on them. Okay, then all of a sudden, they turn around. They've got the pillar of fire on one side of them with Pharaoh's armies off in the distance. And all of a sudden, the Red Sea starts to move. And they go, well, they've got two choices. They can stay there and be killed or drawn back into Egypt by Pharaoh's armies and remain as slaves. And then they would never get out then. If they were ever taken back to Egypt, they had one place to go and one place to go only, and that was to cross the base of the Red Sea that had just moved. Now understand, if you look at a map, they were at the base of the Sinai Peninsula, and they were crossing off the mainland of Egypt over the Red Sea, that small narrow path of water that rises up the western side of the Sinai Peninsula. We know from maps exactly where the Israelites went. We know exactly where they were. Then they went over and they finally ended up camping under the Mount Sinai, or it's also called Mount Moses. We know where all of these places are. So at any rate, the parting of the Red Sea. What was going on there? Well, once again, the Earth is rocking and rolling. This comet is coming by. It has gravitational waves that are being sent into the surface of the Earth. The oceans are developing tides. For the water to be drawn out, it's the exact same phenomenon as a tidal wave. Were there tidal waves at that time? Ask the Mayans. They had tidal waves. The tidal waves said that the Mayans talked about and all of the other ancient civilizations. They said the Mayans said that Quetzalcoatl took the ocean on his back and threw it over the land. What happens with a tidal wave? The first thing that happens is the water is drawn off away from the shore. And then it comes pounding back in. That's the tidal wave. That's what the Israelites were describing. They're describing basically a tidal wave. The water moves out. The ocean separated. They ran across the base of the Red Sea. They got to the other side. And when they were on the other side, the water came back. If that were me there, that's what I would have done. I would have run across the base of the Red Sea when that emptied out, because you had two possibilities. You had either went there, or when that pillar of fire broke, the Egyptian armies were going to come in and kill you all, or drag you back into slavery and beat you bloody. Now, which one would you choose? Okay, I mean, these were real events. These things happened. The comet was coming by, the electrical discharges. Are these fairy tales? Was this something that didn't happen? Why don't the preachers in churches talk about this? These are major events. No, they want to talk about fluff and how nice we should be. And if you feel a little better this week, then gee, maybe we can get back to, work a little harder at, it's just the garbage that's being taught in churches today. It's enough to, it's just unfortunate, because there are real stories that have to be told. There are real stories about our heritage that have to be stressed. These people didn't have it easy. We have it very easy. The people all go home from church. They have a nice breakfast. Everybody feels good. The kids are in school. Mom and dad have a retirement program, and if they vote for the right political party, maybe they'll, we talk about an economic recession, a slowdown, maybe stocks are a little low today. That's the biggest worry that you have today. Compare that to what the Moses and those people were dealing with then. They were slaves. They were being beat and whipped, and they were leaving because there were calamities going on. There were natural catastrophes basically shutting everything down. And finally, Pharaoh said, well, just go. There's nothing else here. So they left. And, of course, the story is that Pharaoh changed his mind, as he had done many times prior to that, and started chasing down the Israelites as they were, basically moving away on foot. Moving down to, they were along that southeastern corner of the on the west bank of the Red Sea, and the Sinai Peninsula across on the east bank from where they were stationed. All of a sudden, here comes Pharaoh's armies, and they described what they saw: the pillar of fire, the pillar of fire. It's a whirling tornado of fire illuminated up into the sky. That was the discharge from the comet. That's what they saw. That was their visual. All of a sudden, the sea parts. What was that all about? The tidal wave that came from the comet, these tidal waves were going on all over the world. It wasn't just where they were. It was all over the world. And when that happened, they had one choice. They didn't have two choices. They couldn't stay there. They had to leave. They ran across, and when the Pharaoh's army, when the pillar of fire finally broke, the Pharaoh's armies came marching into the same basin, and the sea came back over them. They found, like I said, they found the chariots in the Red Sea. These events happened. This is not fairy tale. This is not mythology. These are real events. Okay, now you talk about what the Mayans had said. They recounted the same thing. Let's take some examples of earthquake disaster situations with the Mayas. They talked about the various effects of Quetzalcoatl. Who was Quetzalcoatl? It's the main deity of the Mayan mythology, of the Mayan religion. Who was Quetzalcoatl? It was Venus. Venus. What was the big deal about Venus? We see Venus up in the sky as a little dot. Right now, on June 5th, it's going to have a transit. Everybody's making a big deal about it. But Venus is just a little planet. Why would the Mayans, why would the original inhabitants of Zimbabwe build a huge tracking calendar for the planet Venus. It doesn't make any sense unless Venus were something very different. And that is exactly the point. You have to understand modern science and its view of history, its view of the solar system, is all distorted. It's fairy tale science. It doesn't explain anything. And the only thing that it has accomplished is to destroy the public's view of reality. That we live in a solar system. Oh, we might have a little solar flare here or there. But, you know, any of these disasters couldn't happen to you today. Well, no, they can happen to you today. And Planet X type objects, which are simply Venus at that time, when you could easily have called it a Planet X object. One of the biggest pieces of misinformation regarding this entire topic of Planet X is that there's only one Planet X. That there's just one of them. And if it didn't come in 2003, then it doesn't exist. What kind of logic is that? Well, it's the kind of logic of misinformation. That's the kind of logic it is. Remember that the misinformation crews have created teams of nutcases running around the internet, jumping up and down. Some of them saying every time a comet comes by that that's Planet X, that that's Nibiru, or whatever. This is all smoke and mirrors to distract the public. How many thousands of ways have they created to distract the public's real understanding of what's going on in this solar system? I couldn't even count. It's daily and it continues. Well, what's the main end result? Well, they don't want people understanding their true history. If people understood their true history, they would understand that these events have happened in the past, they can happen in the future, and yes, the government is going to hide this information at all costs. So anybody working for the government, any scientists, they're not allowed to tell you about anything like this that might happen in the future. They're not allowed to talk about this. It's just not in the cards. They have people out there, bloggers and other government basically sponsored web pages, etc., to try and minimize the damage of the kind of information that I'm trying to put out to the public. The public has to first wake up. 95% of the public would listen to a lecture like this and they would have no idea what to think about it. They'd go back to their church next Sunday and listen to how everything is nice and rosy and we have to just be good, citizens, and everything's going to be great. Yeah. They have never heard real information, so how would they ever recognize it, even if it hit them in the face? This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.